Now listen carefully. I know that we are in the laboratory right now, but all the stuff I'm going to talk about in this recording is both upstairs and downstairs stuff. You have to know it for the upcoming exam, and you have to know it for the lab. And as part of it, I'm going to give you those three slides that I skipped earlier today. That'll finish up the chapter, but I have other things to say as well. So I want to review and extend what I was saying about transport processes earlier today. What are the three mechanisms? The three transport processes that can get things into or out of cells? Passive, active, and vesicular transport, correct. Well, vesicular transport is not involved in what you're doing today, and neither is active transport. I'll leave those as I define them upstairs. I want to go over passive transport in greater detail down here, though, not only because I didn't give you enough detail upstairs, but because it's directly applicable to what you're doing today. Passive transport is often misdefined as being transport that does not require energy. I see people saying this often, and it's not true, like I was saying upstairs. Nothing gets moved for free. So all transport processes require energy, including passive. But passive transport doesn't require any outside additional energy because the energy required for passive transport is already built into the system. What did I say is the source of that energy for passive transport? A gradient, exactly. Now, gradient is a real general term that simply means a difference in some sort of measurement at two different places. So there's all different kinds of gradients. For instance, when you plug something into an AC outlet or a receptacle, you're putting in two prongs, right? Well, there's a difference in what we call the voltage is really a gradient of electrical potential energy, because there's a difference from one to the other connector. And you know, when I use that barrel example, the reason water comes out is because there is a gravitational gradient. Water wants to fall downhill. If you open up a spigot, water comes out because of a pressure gradient. Those are all gradients, but the gradient, the particular kind of gradients we care about in today's lab is a concentration gradient, which means that at point A, wherever that is measured, there is a higher concentration of whatever particle you're talking about compared to the concentration at point B. If there is a difference, then there is a gradient. The gradient is that difference. But what is the really important thing that I told you to remember about gradients in general? Yes, any gradient is a form of stored energy and therefore can do some work for you. Well, in the case of passive transport, which is diffusion, that is what the gradient is used for. The gradient itself is what causes the movement of particles from high concentration to low concentration. And that kind of is background information to say something about diffusion that kind of seems self-contradictory. Diffusion, which is passive transport, is a directed process, meaning that it happens in one direction, specifically from high concentration to low concentration. That's a directed process. But despite being a directed process, it's caused by random movement of particles. In any sample of particles, each individual particle is moving at its own speed and in its own direction. That's why overall it's random movement. And we call that overall random movement Brownian motion. after a dead guy named Brown. All right, so that's the randomness of it. But even though the particles are randomly moving, diffusion occurs in a particular direction from high concentration to low concentration. Well, it does make sense, though, when you think about it. If you have a compartment, a square, it would really be in three dimensions, but we'll just consider it in two dimensions, and you have a high concentration of particles somewhere, like in the center, then that's a gradient, right? Because there's a high concentration here, there's a low concentration elsewhere in that compartment. Each particle is moving randomly with respect to direction and speed, but it's going to cause, over time, particles to go from where there's high concentration to where there's low concentration. Here's why it makes sense. If you imagine yourself being one of these particles, if you want to have any chance at getting away from this crowd, a couple things have to be true. For instance, you can't be one of these ones in the middle, right? Because it doesn't matter which way these ones are traveling, they're not going to get very far. They're just going to knock into another particle, which is going to change their direction and speed. But they're not going to be able to escape right away. So you have to be one of the particles on the periphery or the edge if you have any chance of escaping. That's not enough, though, because if you're one of the edge particles and you're still happen to be moving toward the center of the group, then you're still not going to be able to escape. On the other hand, if you are a particle that's on the edge, plus you happen to be moving in the direction outward, then there's plenty of room for you to do that, and you will leave the crowd. And then the more that happens, the more new particles are now on the edge, some of which will be facing outward and be able to escape as well. So it's random movement, but overall, as a population, the particles have what we call net diffusion, meaning the overall movement of the population is in one direction more so than another. So, you know, yes, some of these particles that leave will also actually go back toward it, but the more particles there are here, the more likely that particles will be moving away than toward that. That's how diffusion works. And diffusion always is passive, and it always occurs from a place of higher concentration to a place of lower concentration. When that happens, we say that the particles are moving down their gradient. And we can also talk about the steepness of a gradient, which simply means how much difference there is. There can be a small difference, which is still a gradient, or a hell of a big difference. That's a steeper gradient. And the steeper the gradient, the more tendency there is for things to diffuse to the lower concentration region. Okay, so that explains why you don't need outside energy. The energy is the gradient itself. Now, all passive transport is diffusion, but there are some special cases we'll talk about in a minute. If these particles that I drew represent sugar molecules in a sugar cube, if I plop a sugar cube into a beaker of water, at that time zero, right when it happens, there's going to be a steep gradient. Actually, there are two gradients. Because there's a gradient for sugar molecules, and there's also a gradient for water. Each different type of particle has its own gradient. The sugar molecules are highly concentrated here and low concentration elsewhere, so they are going to diffuse away from the sugar cube. But at the same time, there's a high concentration of water molecules here and a low concentration at the sugar cube, so water molecules are going to diffuse toward the sugar cube. Each one is going down its own gradient, though, each type of particle. Do you see that? Well, that is just simple diffusion of both of these types of particles, water and sugar in that case. I say simple diffusion because there's nothing stopping them from getting to their low concentration region. So this brings up an important point about diffusion. for diffusion to occur, there have to be two things, two requirements met. One is that there has to be a gradient. If there is zero gradient, which we would call either no gradient or a gradient of zero, no difference in concentration, then there is no tendency for a particle to move one direction more than the other. So no gradient, no diffusion. But that's not enough. That's one requirement, but it's not enough. It's necessary, but not sufficient, in other words. The second requirement is also important, which is that there has to be a way for that particle to get from A to B. The gradient itself is the tendency. In a sense, the particle wants to go down that gradient, but if there's something blocking it, it won't be able to, and therefore there won't be any diffusion. Well, there's nothing blocking anything here because there is no membrane involved. And so now let's look at these slides and talk about membranes being involved. Starting with slide 10. Here we have, on the top row, this is the same compartment but in three different times. And notice that the box or the compartment is subcompartmentalized by this dashed line, which represents a membrane. Now, a membrane is a barrier, but it's not an absolute barrier. It is called a selectively permeable membrane. Because permeable means able to permeate. Permeate means go through. Permeable means that some things are able to go through it. But selectively permeable means only certain things get through it, other things are blocked. Well, in this case, these orange dye molecules, whatever they are permeable to the membrane. And notice that at time zero, before we let the clock run, everything's frozen at the moment, there is a gradient in place, right? Because there's a high concentration of orange dye on the left, a zero concentration on the right, so a pretty steep gradient. If I then start the clock and I'll let these things move around randomly, it's going to be in such a way that they will go through the membrane, some of them, and diffusion occurs down the gradient, so that if you wait long enough to come back, you won't see a gradient anymore. The concentration on the left half is the same as the concentration on the right. And it came to equilibrium. That's one way that you can come to equilibrium. I'll mention another in a minute. But net diffusion, which means movement of particles as a population more in one direction than the other, stops when there's no gradient. That does not mean the particles stop, though, right? All these particles continue to move at equilibrium. So some of them are going from right to left, but just as many are going from left to right. And therefore, there is no net diffusion. There is just Brownian motion. Net diffusion means that particles are going more one direction than another. Okay, now, the bottom illustrates the important fact that I just kind of offhandedly mentioned when I started this recording, and that's that every different kind of particle has its own gradient, and only that type of particle's own gradient matters. So we have two gradients in place here, one for orange dye molecules, one for purple. Well, the orange ones diffuse down their gradient only because that's their gradient. It has nothing to do with what purple is doing. Orange is going down its gradient, so it goes from high concentration to low concentration because they can get through the membrane. Purple is doing the same thing, but that has nothing to do with orange. It's just obeying its own gradient and going from high concentration of purple to low concentration of purple. And once again, if you let it run long enough, both of them will come to equilibrium, because in this case, the gradient is entirely dissipated, meaning it comes to zero. There is no difference in concentrations. Okay, that's all of this is diffusion, but simple diffusion doesn't involve any membranes. Membranes are often involved, though, including in today's experiment. So we need now to talk about a special case of diffusion in slide 11. This is still diffusion. All passive transport is diffusion. But we give it a special name, which is osmosis, if a couple of requirements are met. One requirement for the diffusion to actually be osmosis, which is just a special case of diffusion, is that the particle diffusing, doing the diffusing, is not solute particle, but solvent. The other requirement is that the solvent particles are moving through a selectively permeable membrane. Now notice the picture I drew. If you imagine this being the sugar cube example, well, one of these types of particles, I didn't draw the water molecules, but they're there, right? They're one of the types of particle, and water is solvent, and it's diffusing toward the center. But even though that is solvent diffusing, that's not osmosis, because there's no membrane it's going through. Okay? For it to be osmosis, it has to be solvent, not solute, that's moving, and it has to be moving through a semipermeable membrane. Now, most biology books will say that it's movement of water specifically, not just solvent. And that's simply because in biology, the solvent is always water. But technically speaking, osmosis applies to any solvent going through a semipermeable membrane. The definition that is given for osmosis by most textbooks, in my opinion, is kind of confusing, because it seems to be an exception to diffusion. Most textbooks will write something like, osmosis is movement of water from a place of low solute concentration to a place of high solute concentration. And that's why it kind of sounds like it's an exception, because I just told you that all diffusion is from high to low. But think about what that definition I gave you means. If water is moving from a place of low solute concentration to a place of high solute concentration, that's really just a backwards way of saying that water is moving from a place of high water concentration to a place of low water concentration. Because when you say that the solute concentration is low, that means it's watery. In other words, the solvent has high concentration when the solute is low. Okay? And it's all, not only is it confusing to base it on solute, but it also goes against what I just told you in the previous slide. When water diffuses, it's going down its own gradient, not the solute's gradient. It's the water gradient that actually counts. But anyway, you see that definition in just about any textbook, and I hope you don't be confused by it. All right, so if we involve a selectively permeable membrane and we have solute moving through it, then we have osmosis. Here we have a glass U-tube, and the bottom of it features a selectively permeable membrane through which water can permeate, but not these green molecules, whatever they are. So there are two kinds of particles here, right? Solute and solvent. Each one, therefore, features its own gradient. And the concentration of solutes is high on the right side, low on the left side. Therefore, that is the tendency for green molecules to diffuse to the left. But they don't fulfill the second requirement because they're blocked by the membrane. So even though they have the tendency, the gradient, they're not going to do it. On the other hand, water has a gradient in the other direction. It's more watery on the left, less watery on the right. So it's going to go down its gradient by moving from left to right through the membrane. That is osmosis because water is solvent and it's going through a membrane. Now, if you allow this to happen, you'll see what's pictured on the right side, meaning that the more this happens, the more you're taking water out of the left side and putting it into the right side, and you're not replacing it with anything, right? That's why the level of the liquid goes down on the left and it goes up on the right. Well, here we came to equilibrium, and that's because in this case, according to how the picture looks, the gradient came to zero. Notice that these look like about the same concentration based on the solute spacing. And that's one way that you can have equilibrium, like I said earlier. But I told you I'd tell you about a second way. Now, I don't have a picture, but you have to imagine this. It's not hard to imagine, though. Let's set this up exactly the same way, except with the U-tube on the left side, we have no solute at all. It's just pure water. Okay? You still have both gradients in place and in the same directions as before. But water is the only thing that can get through. If there's pure water on this side, it's going to want to go to the right side. And it will, and therefore the levels will change. But if you started with pure water, notice that it doesn't matter how much water you take away and add to this. You're getting this right side more and more dilute, but you're never going to get it to zero solute, right? So this is still going to have a higher water concentration no matter how much you take away. Therefore, the gradient will not be eliminated. And there will still be a tendency for more water to come in. It'll still stop, though, even though the gradient is still there. And that's because the higher the level gets on the right side, the heavier it gets. Gravity is continuously trying to pull this down, which is like trying to force water back through the membrane, the opposite way it's trying to osmose. So when the force of gravity exactly equals the force of osmosis in the opposite direction, they'll add up to zero forces. And the gradient will still be in place, but it'll be at equilibrium for that reason. Okay, the detail on the bottom just shows you that at equilibrium, or I mean, no, this isn't at equilibrium yet. Until you reach equilibrium, water is moving in more in one direction than another. And that's because of the water gradient. So for osmosis, it's just a special case of diffusion. And so assuming that you remember that osmosis requires movement through a membrane, just think of it as being movement of water down its own gradient. Don't think of it in terms of the solute. Okay, let's go to 12, finish up these slides. Now I need to talk about tonicity, which is a real general word that refers to the tendency for osmosis to occur either into or out of a cell. Tonicity is just the general word for that, but there, as you see on the headings here, are 3 degrees of tonicity, 3 categories. Hypotonicity, isotonicity, and hypertonicity, and their corresponding adjectives, hypotonic, isotonic, and hypertonic. Now, write yourself a little note about this, because the author of this manual gets the use of these words wrong. And I keep forgetting to tell her to fix it in future editions. What she gets wrong, though, is that she disobeys this important thing. None of these three words, hypertonic, hypotonic, isotonic, should ever be used to describe a cell. They don't describe a cell. Those words describe the environment, the exterior of the cell. So a cell is in either a hypotonic environment, an isotonic environment, or a hypertonic environment. The cell itself is not hypertonic or hypotonic or isotonic. And so if she says, if she uses language that implies that, ignore it. Obey me on that. Okay? Let's talk about the three. Now, these three definitions are also kind of backwards and therefore confusing. And that's because they are based on the solute, when what really matters is the water, the solvent, not the solute. But let's make sense of them linguistically. What is different about them, of course, is just the prefix. What does hypo as a prefix mean? It means below, right. Hypodermic means below the skin, for instance. Well, what's below is the solute here, not the solvent, even though the solvent is what matters, and that's why this is confusing. A hypotonic solution is one that has a lower overall solute concentration than the solution inside the cell has. Okay? Now, just realize that that's just a backwards way of saying that a hypotonic solution is more watery than the solution in the cell. Okay? And that's why it's confusing. Hypo means low, but it's really more watery. Always think of hypotonic as being more watery than the cell. In all cases of osmosis, since osmosis is diffusion, water is going down its gradient. Water always osmoses to the place where it's less watery. Well, if it's a hypotonic solution, then a cell like this red blood cell, representing an animal cell, will gain water because water is going to where it's less watery, which would be into the cell. And this is an animal cell. You already know from upstairs that animal cells don't have cell walls. They have only a flimsy plasma membrane. So if too much water comes in by osmosis, the cell will burst. Plasma membrane can't hold that pressure. But there's a special word for bursting in of a cell in this condition, which is lysis. That's the noun. The cell is lysed. That's the verb. Notice that lysis means splitting. It's you're rupturing the cell. It's the same word as in hydrolysis or lysosome. So animal cells do not do well in a hypotonic environment because they can't stand up to the osmotic pressure. Let's go to the other extreme before the middle. A hypertonic solution is one that has a higher overall solute concentration compared to the solution in the cell, which is just a backwards way of saying that a hypertonic solution is less watery than the cell. Water is always going to go to where it's less watery, but in this case, the gradient is just reversed compared to a hypotonic solution, right? If you put an animal cell in a hypertonic solution, water is going to go out of the cell because it's less watery outside. Well, just like you'll explode an animal cell if too much water comes in, when you lose water from an animal cell, it's going to shrivel. That flimsy plasma membrane will collapse. There's a special word given to the shriveling, though, which is crenation. With an N, not an M. And the cell will crenate. That is also bad for the cell. It will kill it if it's severe enough. So animal cells don't do well in either extreme. Iso as a prefix means same. And so an isotonic solution is one that has an overall solute concentration that is the same as the solute concentration in the cell. And that's just a backwards way of saying that an isotonic solution is equally watery compared to the cell. Now, an isotonic solution doesn't have to be the same kind of solution as what's in the cell. For instance, today you're using potato cells. There's a bunch of starch in the potato cells. That's one kind of solute. And you're bathing those in the environment that you're adjusting in sugar water, right? Sucrose. So those are two totally different solutes. But if you have, just to put numbers to it, if you have a 0.6 molar concentration of sucrose on the outside and a 0.6 molar concentration of starch on the inside, even though they're totally different kinds of concentrations, the fact that the solute concentrations are equal means they're equally watery. And that's really what matters. And that's what isotonicity is, the situation in which the wateriness outside is the same as the wateriness inside the cell. And therefore, water, still able to move through the membrane, will move through the membrane, but just as much water will leave the cell as will enter it. And there therefore is no change in volume overall. The cell stays nice and well-formed like a red blood cell should. Animal cells, in other words, survive in an isotonic solution. And that's why a big part of your homeostasis is maintenance of osmotic gradients so that your cells don't burst or shrivel. All three of these words, by the way, are comparative words. You would never call a solution just by itself any of these three words. You only use these words when you compare that solution as an environment to a cell that's in that solution. That makes sense? And therefore, the same solution could be hypotonic to a certain kind of cell and hypertonic to another kind of cell. Let's look at the plants. These are plant cells on the bottom. And you already know that a plant cell differs from animal cells by having a strong and thick exterior cell wall in addition to the plasma membrane. So the cell wall is really like the structure of this wall of this room. And this plasma membrane is just like the paint on the inner surface of that wall. Well, if you put a plant cell into a hypotonic solution, hypotonic still means the same thing. It's more watery than the cell. So, just as for an animal cell, water is going to come into the plant cell. But it's not going to burst the plant cell because the cell wall material can hold the pressure. So water will come in until the force exerted by the walls pushing back on the water exactly equals the force coming in. And that will swell the plant cell. It will be turgid or nice and plump. That's the ideal situation for plants, being in a hypotonic environment. And by the way, when you water a plant, that's what you're doing. You're making its environment hypotonic, right? Giving it pure water. Well, this is a single cell, but of course a plant is trillions or quadrillions of cells, depending on how big it is. Each one of them is doing this, though, in a hypotonic environment. They're all becoming turgid, but they're connected to each other by these cell wall barriers between the cells. When each cell itself gets turgid, they all push on each other. And this causes an erection in the plant. It's very similar to an erection of a penis, except that that's blood pressure. Whereas in a plant, it's osmotic pressure, bringing water in from the hypotonic environment. And you know, if you have a plant that stands up by itself without any stiff materials in it, it's because of that. And if you forget to water it, it will droop, right? If you catch that in time and restore the hypotonic environment by watering it, it'll go back up because of osmosis. If you put it into an isotonic solution, a plant cell, it will survive, but it won't be as good as hypotonic, because water will both enter and leave, and the plant cell will be flaccid. It'll be limp. It won't have that erection I was talking about with respect to pushing on other cells next to it. The other extreme, though, a hypertonic solution is truly bad for a plant cell. And that's because even though the cell wall material won't collapse, when water comes out of the cell, it's coming out from inside the plasma membrane. And so the plasma membrane is going to... what the hell's the word when it comes off of the surface? Peel. Yes, it's peeling off of the cell wall. And that's a process called plasmolysis, as a noun. Plasmolyzed is the verb. That will kill the cell. I want you to be careful, though, with the word plasmolysis, because it ends in lysis. But it's not a rupture because of high pressure. It's not like the lysis of an animal cell in the other environment. Plasmolysis is the plant version of crenation in animal cells because of hypertonic environment. All right, any of that? Any questions on any of that? I think 13, yeah, 13 I already did upstairs. So those are those slides. Now I need to talk a little bit about the experiment. Remember that, just like before, there's a specific set of questions that you need to answer. Those are at the end of the chapter. Pay attention to the due date that I don't have memorized, but it's on Canvas somewhere. And I'm sure that I made the due date well past the exam on purpose, because I don't want you to really think about this until after the test. I prioritize the upcoming test. But what you need to get today in order to write this eventually are your raw data, which are basically those two measurements of mass. So make sure that everyone, before you leave, has the raw data. And also, before you leave, you need to, as a group, one per group, make a whiteboard drawing following the instructions in the manual. But make sure you approve that with me before you leave. And once I do approve your drawing, everyone take a picture of it, because if you include that in your Word document, you get bonus points. And you don't want to waste bonus points in this course. Okay? Once I do approve it and you have the pictures taken, make sure you erase your whiteboard before you leave. Before I forget, though, I'll talk about the graph in a minute. But before I forget, I want to mention these things over here you're supposed to look at, these trays. Now, if there's like an anti-aging cream commercial or something where you have a before and after picture, people just get that intuitively. They don't say, oh, that's two people. They realize it's the same person at two different times. But for some reason, even though these are labeled before and after, people think these are two different containers. This is the same container before and then later. Same with the strawberries ones. So think of it that way and look at them and see what's happening in those. Now back to the report. Most of the report is pretty straightforward. You're, of course, as usual, making a graph. Remember that you're, regardless of what the manual might say, you are not giving me a hard copy. You're doing it in Word, submitting one document to Canvas. So your picture of your whiteboard plus your graph have to be inserted into the one document that you submit. Most of it is pretty straightforward, but I want to talk about the graph a little bit, because it has to do actually with the overall goal of doing this experiment. And I think that might be the title, but regardless of what the title is, what you're trying to do with this experiment is determine the solute concentration in the cell But obviously you are not directly measuring that, right? All you are measuring is mass before and mass after. Well, before I get too far on that, let me tell you that there's a proper way to measure a difference in science. We use the delta notation for difference. You're getting an initial mass and a final mass. So what you want is change in mass, delta mass. And mathematically speaking, there are two ways you could compute that, right? A minus B or B minus A. They're both differences. But there's one proper way to do this for science. Change in mass, or change in whatever, but mass, it should always be the final minus the initial. So it's mass final minus mass initial. There's a good reason for that. If you make a measurement, the final measurement, and the mass is bigger than it was for the initial measurement, what does that mean just in common sense terms? What does that tell you? What is it?
Water.
Right. The potato took on water. Well, since it's defined this way, final minus initial, that would mean bigger minus smaller, and therefore it would be, the delta would be a positive number. Positive numbers mean gain. But if it lost mass, then it would be smaller minus bigger, and that would be a negative number. If you don't use the right order, you won't have the right sign. And the sign is just as important as the magnitude, the value of the number. Okay? Now, about graphing. Usually, well, I'll get to that in a minute. What do we have on the y-axis? Well, actually, let's start with the x-axis. The x-axis is independent variable, right? What's the independent variable today? What is it?
The molar concentration.
Exactly. Concentration, and you would write it all out. Concentration of solution, and as your unit, you had molar with capital M. And remember last time I said that some of you are going to give me an axis that is not spaced properly? Some of you did. So listen to these recordings before you write your report. What are your three concentration values? 0, 0.3, and 0.5. Well, don't do this. This is not like red, blue, and green. They're not categories. They're numerical values. So the spacing between 0 and 0.3 is not the same as 0.3 and 0.5. Don't do that. Space them properly. What do we have as a dependent variable? Yes, the mass is what you directly measure. You'd measure it twice, right? Those are the raw data, initial and final masses. But that's not what you graph. You don't graph initial mass, you don't graph final mass. You compute change in mass, and that's what goes on the y-axis. Okay, so delta mass in grams. And I don't know what your graph's going to look like, but I'm just going to put three dots here. It's not surprising that they're not perfectly collinear, right? Because they're real data, but it looks like they're linear. So we're justified in fitting a line of best fit. You should be much more careful and use a ruler. But anyway, that's just a review of how to do graphs. What I really want to talk about is that almost no one really gets the point of one important question in the report, which is really the whole intent of the experiment. There's one question that asks, I don't remember how it's worded, but it asks you to figure out the solute concentration of the potato cells. And as I was saying before, you're not directly measuring that, right? All you're measuring is mass. And you're supposed to be able to get that from this graph. Well, how could you possibly know what the solute concentration is in the potato cells? By my definitions of tonicity is the answer. Right? What did I say is the definition of isotonicity? It is equally watery, but when you phrase it in terms of solutes, an isotonic solution has the same solute concentration as the cell does. Well, you're not graphing potato concentrations here at all. You're graphing environment concentrations. But by definition, an isotonic solution has the same concentration as the potato, and that's what you're trying to find. So answering the question really just boils down to finding the isotonic concentration from the graph. How do you know what an isotonic concentration is? Well, when you number this y-axis, you might be tempted to start it at zero because you do so often. That's wrong, right? It's because of what I was saying. A change in mass can be positive, zero, or negative. So you should have some negative numbers, some positive numbers, and then zero somewhere. But if you, it's very likely that none of the three environments you're using, none of your three concentrations, is isotonic. What if you did have a truly isotonic solution and you put the potato slabs in them, what would happen? The mass would not change. That's the really important thing. Well, remember interpolation. That's what you use a line of best fit for. A zero change in mass, if you go straight from zero, wherever it is on your axis, straight over to the line of best fit, and then straight down and read that concentration, that's what the isotonic concentration would be. It's probably not going to be one of your 3 points, but it'll be somewhere on the line. And if it's an isotonic concentration, then by definition, the potato has that same concentration. That's how you figure out the potato concentration. Now, does all that make sense? Well, I'm telling you exactly how to do this, so listen to the recording and do it this way if you want points. Now, you also have some red blood cell things to look at. As far as cleaning up, one other thing. It tells you a specific time to wait, but whenever I shut up, it's the end of the soak. So whenever I shut up, get your ending masses. But just realize that potatoes make a hell of a starchy mess on the counter. So in addition to throwing away chunks like peels and stuff into the regular trash, wipe off your surface. Wipe off the counter surface over here. And then make sure you call me over to approve your whiteboard before you leave. And no one leave without making sure you have all the data and a picture of the board.